there. This is the Cory Doctorow podcast. In fact, it's the last Cory Doctorow podcast for a couple of months or so. I'm about to go on holidays. But before I get into that, let me thank you all for those of you who attended last week's event with China Mayville in Exmouth Market. It was quite exciting. In addition to both of us doing very good readings, if I do say so myself, we were upstaged somewhat by a visitor from Vancouver who was overcome apparently by a low blood pressure incident and fainted dead away in the middle of the church that they were holding the event in. We outgrew the bookstore in Exmouth Market, Clerkenwell Tales, and moved into the church next door. And she was in quite good spirits after she recovered consciousness, and I even signed a book for her. But we ended up adjourning to the street outside the church, to the Exmouth Market, a kind of pedestrianized zone, and signing books out there in the road. And we all had a very good time, I must say. Even it appears the lady who fainted dead away, who wrote to me later and said that she was feeling fine and had quite enjoyed the public medicine here in the United Kingdom. Luckily for us, also our host or our MC from Penn, his wife is a pediatrician, so she just happened to be sitting in the audience next to the lady who fainted. So there was an MD in attendance at that moment. That was great. So as I said, I'm about to go on holidays. On Wednesday morning, I hit the road with the family until August the 29th. We're going to be sitting on a lake in Ontario and not doing anything, not socializing, not blogging, not emailing, not nothing. Well, I tell a lie. I have one press day scheduled in Toronto for my Canadian distributors. And apart from that, I'm off to be offline. I'm going on an email fast, a phone fast, a web fast, a blogging fast, and a podcasting fast. And I will be offline until August the 29th. Now, I will be back shortly thereafter. On the 1st of September, I get back on the 29th of August. And on the 1st of September, I get on a plane and fly to Melbourne, Australia, where I will be at the Melbourne Writers Festival, followed by the World Science Fiction Convention. And that's September 2nd through 5th. And so those of you in Melbourne, I hope to see you. And then immediately, more or less after getting back from that, I fly to Germany for a 10-day, 12-city tour of Germany for the German edition of Little Brother. And then finally, from the 23rd to the 25th of September, I'm going to be in Amsterdam for Picnic and for a side event organized by Bits of Freedom to celebrate the Dutch edition of my book, Makers. So I will be in all of those places. The details are now up on Boing Boing. If you go down the sidebar there, you'll see it. And I hope to see you at some or all of those events if you happen to be tracking my travels. Now, on to the story that I'm going to read to you today. The story is called Ghosts in My Head, and it was commissioned originally by a big slick magazine that was paying quite a respectable rate for it. And I wrote the story. It was commissioned by an old friend of mine who was guest editing the fiction series. And then I got a contract, and the contract was really unsuitable. That's not uncommon. A lot of the times magazines will start with a really, really unsuitable contract, and you send it back, and they send you a slightly better one, and then you kind of line out a few things, and you come up with something that everybody can more or less agree with. And it's, again, kind of common practice for the editors and for the contracts departments to work completely out of sync, so you don't even know what the contract terms are going to be when you start working. You just assume in good faith that everybody's going to adjust the terms in the ways that are normal to the industry. Well, that's not what happened here. They made a couple of major concessions, it must be said. They'd originally wanted all the rights to the story and also film rights and the right to make, you know, theme park rides out of it and so on without any compensation. That's a little silly. And they were willing to waive that, but there was still a bunch of liability stuff that was really inappropriate to have in the story. Also, their copy editors, their sub-editors were really terrible and had lots of dumb ideas, like they didn't want me to use the words Procter & Gamble in the story because they thought that the company might sue, or I guess more likely, be less likely to advertise in this big slick magazine. So, in the end, we couldn't agree. And they just stonewalled me. I would email them, and they wouldn't email me back. I'd phone them, and they wouldn't phone me back. I'd phone the editor-in-chief. I'd email the editor-in-chief. Nothing, nothing, nothing. I got word that the CEO himself had said that they wouldn't make the adjustments to my contract, not because he objected to them in principle, but because he thought that modifying a contract for a mere freelancer was not a good deal for his company, that it just wasn't worth asking a lawyer to do the modification. And so he wouldn't have any of it, even though I'd done done this work on good faith. So I decided it's time to demand a kill fee. So the Science Fiction Writers of America, the grievance committee there, Michael Capobianco, started to call up and speak to the various people at this publisher and eventually negotiated that they would give me 50% of the money that they promised me and I would get the story back. So I put this news on Boing Boing in the form of an appreciation for the grievance committee and the very good work that they do. It is one of the major benefits that the Science Fiction Writers of America provide to the field. And the post was read by many, including the editors at Subterranean Press, who bought the short story from me for the sum that was outstanding, essentially for 50% of what this Slick magazine had paid, which was a lot more than Subterranean paid, but about more or less what I would have expected to get paid for it if I'd been commissioned for it. So everybody was pretty happy with it. And they published it, and they even went out and asked Dave McKean if they could buy the artwork that had been commissioned by this magazine for it. If you don't know Dave McKean, he's really a wonderful illustrator. He does a lot of Neil Gaiman's books, and he did the cover for my novel, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, the U.S. edition anyway. And Dave was game because he's a swell guy, and I guess because they offered him a good rate. And so it all came together, and they published it pretty recently, at the beginning of the summer, and they have given me permission to podcast it for you. If you go to the podcast notes for this story, you'll find the URL for the Subterranean Press edition. You can also just Google Ghosts in My Head, and you'll find it. I really hope you'll go and check out all the stuff that Subterranean publishes. They do really run some great fiction. The same issue that this is in also includes a short story by Lucius Shepard, of all people, who's really one of the great masters of the field. So I do hope you'll go and check out Subterranean Press's online magazine. It's very nice to have had the chance to podcast to you since my last holiday, my last great hiatus, and I hope to hear and speak to you very soon when I get back. And now, Ghosts in My Head. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to begin by thanking you for not lynching me. You laugh, but I'm not joking. Not entirely. There was a time when it was a toss-up as to who would string me up first, the authors, the copyright lawyers, the military, or the neurologists. There was a time when it was inconceivable to me that I would be feted by a distinguished crowd such as yourself in my heels, tights, and a dress, gifted with a fine rubber chicken banquet. There was a time when I contemplated plastic surgery and a move to the ass end of remotest imaginary Stan. I didn't set out to destroy narrative, reshape the law, and invent sixth-generation warfare. I set out to do something entirely slimier. I set out to create a genuine science of persuasion. Simply put, I set out to instrument the human brain and to discover where a representation of the other lives. The fMRI was such a wonderful toy in those days. We were like Leeuwenhoek at his eyepiece, uncovering the secret world that had ever existed right before our eyes. Finally, neuroscience transitioned to a real science, a muscular, macho, quantitative science, no longer a ghetto of twinkle-eyed Oliver Sackses, reliant on keen observations of human behavior. Finally, we could abolish empathy and retreat to the comfortable remove of empiricism as delivered on the screen of an instrument. And when the fMRI shrank to the size of a bowler hat, the tinfoil beanie, we used to call it, and don't worry too much if you don't get the joke anymore, because you shouldn't get the joke, not anymore. Not now that mind-reading is a quotidian miracle like atom smashing. Sorry, where was I? When the tinfoil beanie appeared, well, that was it. That was the big bang for us, the moment at which neuroscience proposed to crush every mystery of the human mind with numerical analysis. Me, I used it to hunt ghosts. Specifically, the ghost of my mother. She died when I was 14, suddenly, and ever since then I'd carried her ghost in my head, a presence and a voice, my moral compass, an internal monologue from beyond the grave, advising me. Careful, she'd say when I got too close to a man who had more pretty than smarts. Pretty gets old fast, smart gets better with age. Somewhere between my ears dwelt an avatar of a long-dead person, a simulation of her based on my brain's interpolation of the data it had on her reactions. And not just her. I carried around Inigo Montoya, the Great Gatsby, Jane Austen, Luke Skywalker, a whole murder of ghosts, if that is the collective noun, and if it isn't, it should be, crammed into my skull. And I found her. Found all of them. Found out exactly what it is that causes people, real and imaginary, to take up residence in our heads. The work was funded by Procter & Gamble, one of their Blue Sky projects, accounting for a fraction of a percentile of their giant marketing budget. Yes, marketing. For once we discovered the ghost center of the brain, we set out to hack it. It turns out that there are innumerable shortcuts for reaching into the human mind and causing it to synthesize a homunculus. It's all that neocortical real estate, all that stuff dating from the rise of the social ape and his social problems. Will this other ape screw me, beat me to death, share his fruit, hide in the bushes while we forage and then eat the bananas? We've spent the entire neocortical era honing our ghost centers, and now I had mastered them for PNG. And PNG loved it. They used it to drive the people on their adverts directly into your head, bypassing all your other sensibilities. Their 20-second dramas over hand lotion and cleaning products and snack food were your problems. Their jeopardy was your jeopardy. Like the primitive audience who fled the Lumiere brothers' early cinematic locomotive, the first generation of people we attacked with this science were unable, neurologically incapable, of distinguishing fact from fiction. And that was too good to last. The PNG hearings were the trial of the decade, and for every person watching and shaking his head in anger, two more were scratching their noggins, inspired by the idea of what they could do with my techniques. By the time the hearings were out, publishers were paying record advances for books by authors whose agents whispered that they were a party to PNG's wicked little secrets. As far as I know, no one from PNG ever disclosed my techniques, but as is so often the case, merely knowing that something can be done is sufficient hint to determine how it can be done. And here we sit in the glorious ruins of society. Those of you under 30 correctly view narrative as a kind of harmful drug, a synthetic means of evincing pathological reactions from an evolutionary backdoor left behind in our brains. Some of you are probably old enough to remember the days when we thought authors should own their characters, back before we realized that the definition of a successful author was a hacker who slips one over on your personal sim. It could have been worse. How many of you remember family counseling? And hell, it's not as though a lot of good hasn't come of it. Here, listen to this. You are all very kind to honor my daughter this way. She makes me proud every day. It's creepy the way it comes out in her voice, isn't it? Without even moving my lips, no less. They say we never die if someone still remembers us. Who knew that it was literally true? I sure hope it is, anyway. At this point, the doctor stepped away from the podium and popped like a soap bubble. The class stretched its legs and left the room, and in their heads, the doctor jostled for space among all the other ghosts. Well, thank you very much, and I'll talk to you when the summer is out. I hope you have as relaxing a time as I plan on having. Bye! You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike, US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.